Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I bet Thomas Malthus was a real drag as a dinner guest. He was the guy who, starting in 1798, made it his personal mission to warn humankind about how the world would end. The global population would keep rising, he said, but agricultural yields were bound to top out. 220 years later, there are nearly 10 times as many people as in Malthus's era. It's hard to imagine what he would say to learn that in many parts of the world, overeating is a greater risk to human health than malnutrition. The thing is, bad news grabs our attention in a way that good news doesn't, compelling us to take action to prevent the worst outcomes. But then when our efforts pay off, we fail to adjust our thinking, which makes us gloomier about the present and the future than we need to be. The new book by journalist and author Greg Easterbrook is called It's Better Than It Looks, Reasons for Optimism in an Age of Fear. He joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington to talk about it. Greg, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
You call yourself a cynical optimist. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things I'm trying to accomplish with this book, It's Better Than It Looks, is to make optimism intellectually respectable again. If you look 100 years back in history, the progressive movement of that time, when the word progressive was spelled with a capital P, progressives of that time believed in the perfectibility of society, which now seems a quaint idea, but at that time people thought that everyone could be free, everyone could be safe, everyone could be well-fed and housed and clothed, and that was fundamentally an optimistic vision. Today, if you don't think the world is falling apart, then you must not understand the situation. And I want to make optimism intellectually respectable again. Optimism is not only, I think, the fact-based way to understand the world, because almost all objective trends, the ones that we can measure, have been positive for many years, if not for decades. But optimism is also the best frame for understanding the challenges to come. If you want reforms for climate change and inequality and other vexing problems, the arguments based on optimism are much better than arguments based on pessimism. But that doesn't mean you got to be a Pollyanna who's smiling all the time. I call myself a cynical optimist. An optimist can be angry. There was just a school shooting in Maryland where I live. That makes me really angry. But you can be really angry and still optimistic that the things that make you angry can be fixed.
You note that even as Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump both were running presidential campaigns to appeal to people who believe things have never been worse, they had very different solutions, but that was their call to people. The misery index of unemployment plus inflation was at a modern low.
Yes, if you think about what really hurts the average person, there are many things, but the two things that hurt the average person most our inability to find a job and rising prices. And we express those two combined in a thing called the misery index, which combines unemployment with the inflation rate. And on the misery index, the lower the number is, the better. On the day that Donald Trump was elected, declaring American carnage and saying everything in our country is always bad, it's down, 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 the misery index was the lowest that it had been since early in the Dwight Eisenhower administration. And yet 63 million people who voted for Donald Trump were convinced that everything is always bad. It's down, down, down. And the people who voted against Trump weren't that cheerful either.
President Trump also talked a lot about crime. Lots of Americans right now are deeply afraid of street crime and of home invasions and of mass violence and of police violence. We're less likely to be hurt or killed by crime than we were a generation or two ago.
Oh, yes, very dramatically. Now, you should be afraid of crime. Even a little bit of crime is too much, especially violent crime. But FBI statistics show that violent crime in the United States peaked in the year 1993 and has been declining almost every year since. Now, there are occasional awful exceptions, the school shootings and the shooting in the Texas church a few months ago. There are awful, awful exceptions. But if you look at your odds of being a crime victim, your odds have gone steadily down since 1993. And odds of being a crime victim have gone down, not in every country in the world, but in almost all the countries in the world, as have your odds of being a victim of war. You wouldn't believe it from the tenor of cable news, but the intensity and the frequency of combat has declined steadily during the last generation, and almost everywhere in the world, any person's odds of dying by violence, and this includes any person in Afghanistan, odds of dying by violence right now are the lowest that they've been in human history.
Why do we remember otherwise? What causes us to romanticize like the way things were when we were growing up and assume that it was better and simpler then?
We all engage in nostalgia for the past. I certainly do, Chris, and I bet you do too. But our nostalgia is clouded by memory. When Donald Trump was running, he would constantly say, "I love the old days. I wish we were back in the good old days." And Hillary Clinton said the same thing. "Back in the old days, there used to be prosperity, she would say. Well, when exactly were these old days? What year did they occur? What town did this happen in? If you look in any point in the American past, many, if not most, objective barometers were much more negative than they are today. Discrimination, pollution were worse, lifespans were shorter, living standards were much lower, education levels were much lower. And that's at any point, name a year. And yet we want to romanticize the past as a better time, and it's human nature to believe, it's human nature to feel self-pity. So by romanticizing the past, we say, oh, things used to be good, but then it was all stolen away from us by mysterious forces that we're conveniently unable to name.
I was thinking about the fact that, you know, a lot of children are protected from news of this sort of thing until a particular age. So maybe we're all inclined to think there was no crime until we were 12 or 13, that sort of thing.
Well, you go back at least to Plato, which was 2,600 years ago. What did Plato write? Plato wrote that the world was sweetly ordered in his youth and is now going to hell in a handbasket, although he didn't actually use the Greek word for handbasket. So how is it that all of us experience life, or almost all of us? Almost all of us are born to the experience of parents taking care of everything, all of our needs provided for. We haven't lost our innocence yet. We haven't felt betrayed or had to struggle to survive. As life passes along, as we get older, we all go through those experiences. And then we all reach, or almost all of us, reach middle age. And from the point of middle age forward, the only condition that a human being can experience is personal decline, even if your life is going really well. So we have an aging society. In Europe, there's an aging society. And now China also has an aging society. Aging societies tend to perceive themselves as in decline because individuals are projecting their personal situations onto their larger societies.
Wow. And in this country, certainly it's about the time that people reach midlife that they have, you know, they begin to have more power in the media. You know, the people running corporations tend to be in their 40s and 50s.
Yes, that's true. And the baby boom is just kind of losing its grip on the media and the business establishment. But the baby boomers have been controlling things now for 10, 15 years. And what's happening to baby boomers? Even ones whose lives have gone very well are experiencing personal decline. So they project that onto their countries. And I think this is one reason voters, not just in the United States, remember voters in the same year that they bought Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders' arguments from the right and the left, but the same basic argument that the country was falling apart, English voters bought the same argument in the Brexit resolution. Even though what's happened in the last 50 years in England, the longest period without combat in all of English history, plus rising prosperity. And yet voters were convinced things were getting worse.
You remind us that the dictators aren't winning. How does the democratic map of the world compare with what it looked like during and after World War II?
Well, pretty good, although it certainly could be better. In the last 10 years or so, we've had what the theorist Larry Diamond of Stanford calls a democracy recession, where in Russia, Turkey, and a few other nations, we've had sort of moderate backsliding, not all-out dictatorships, but certainly not positive trends. But if you compare, and it's better than it looks, I say, think about how the world looked in 1940. Summer of 1940, dictatorship of the fascist, imperialist, or communist variety controlled almost the whole world. Only the United States, England, Australia, Canada, and a handful of other nations were holding the line for human liberty. And now think where we are today. 70% of the residents of our world participate in genuine free party elections. That's by far the highest percentage of actual voting in democracy in the history of the world. And this is happening with, as you noted, a much larger population than we had when World War II ended.
So how do we put Xi Jinping's elevation to president for life into perspective? Almost a fifth of the world lives under his rule today.
Well, it's certainly not good. It's part of the democracy recession. China has been an authoritarian society for almost all of its existence. The Chinese government is pushing its way in the direction of authoritarianism. And as you know, the joke about China is that they've now built a great firewall around free information in that society. So I wouldn't point to China as my first example. On the other hand, India is the largest democracy our world has ever seen, and it's a fitful democracy. India is a pretty crazy place. I don't know if you've been there lately. It's both crowded and crazy sociologically, but it's also a secular democracy with 900 million people. As recently as World War II or as recently as the Cold War, I think most intellectuals would have said that that was impossible.
It seems almost miraculous that malnutrition is at record lows, given a global population of 7.6 billion as of today. What are we doing right in our ability to feed the world?
Well, the Green Revolution has been much more successful than generally given credit for, and that's, we can't be certain it will always continue to succeed, but it sure looks that way. When you mentioned Thomas Malthus at the beginning of the show, he did not know that high-yield agriculture would ever be possible. So he thought that
Or birth control, or both.
He thought that population would always increase more rapidly than agricultural output, and that that was an iron law, that it couldn't be altered. Thinkers as recently as Karl Marx have thought the same thing. In the 1850s, Karl Marx thought that starvation was inevitable because people would reproduce faster than food could be grown. And Green Revolution techniques have turned out to turn that assumption on its head. In every year except one in the post-war era, global food output has increased faster than global population. And although in some parts of the world, including the breadbasket areas of the United States, it looks like we're pretty close to top yield, average yield could come up a huge amount. There's still a lot of potential for increasing the world's agricultural output.
So we're producing enough calories for everybody to eat, but there is still hunger. Is that about distribution or corruption? What is the problem in places where lots of people really are hungry?
Mainly both those things that you mentioned. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, which is a very reliable outfit, says that with each of the last 10 years, the percentage of the world living in malnutrition has been the lowest in human history, but it's still because the human family has gotten so much larger. It's still a significant number of people, and in almost every case, it's because of lack of distribution. In parts of Africa, things as simple as reliable roadways are needed, and because of government corruption, that workers' paradise, Venezuela, that's such a horrible place, could be a prosperous country if the government wasn't so corrupt, and the hunger that exists there is all ties to government corruption.
It's interesting to look at Venezuela because right now it's sort of living through what, you know, pessimists have said the whole world might look like, and yet much of the world doesn't look like Venezuela.
Venezuela is nothing. The problems there are not resource shortages. Almost all primary resources are in oversupply in almost all of the world. In Venezuela, it's a failed state, and it's a failed state based on a failed model. Everywhere where hardline communism has been tried, it's led to suffering for average people. That's a separate question from could some soft form of socialism work, but hardline communism just leads to suffering.
My guest is writer Greg Easterbrook. We're talking about his new book, It's Better Than It Looks, Reasons for Optimism in an Age of Fear. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send a question via Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Greg Easterbrook. His new book is called It's Better Than It Looks, Reasons for Optimism in an Age of Fear. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Greg, we've been doing this show for a little over a decade, and early on, I remember we got pitches almost weekly about peak oil. 12 years on, fuel is still around. It's pretty cheap. There are some environmental consequences to that. But how have we managed to continue extracting resources?
Well, oil and natural gas both are in oversupply, I think a lot of economists would say. And certainly the producers aren't happy with the price trends because the more supply, the lower the price. And coal is definitely in oversupply. So a couple of things have happened. One is that extraction technology has improved. Those of your listeners who are in the oil and gas industry know it's not just hydraulic fracturing, although that's a factor, but 3D seismology has been a huge improvement in the extraction of oil and gas from the earth. And secondly, there's the immensity of the Earth's crust, which is still very, very large compared to human action. Obviously, it's finite, but it's finite on a scale that is many, many generations into the future. And I think also when it was perceived that oil and gas were about to become depleted, people didn't really understand the economics of that particular profession. The higher the price is, the more incentive there is to improve technology to draw out more oil and gas. And when oil and gas were very expensive in the 1990s, the result was a lot of technological innovation that now produces more supply.
So the climate is still changing. Lots of life forms and habitats are adapting to temperatures that they didn't evolve for. What can we take from earlier environmental efforts that would give us some optimism for our ability to deal with climate change?
Well, here's a big point, Chris. I think first, let's make clear that I think the scientific case for human influence on climate is open and shut at this point. There's overwhelming evidence
us.
It's us. Yeah. Well, we're a factor. Obviously, nature has its own point of view of this, but human behavior is now a factor, and there's just no disputing that. So when you go back, and one of the things I try to do, and it's better than it looks, is say that you look at these past issues that were bad and then got good. Oil supply is one. Reduction of smog is another. Reduction of acid rain is another. What caused them to get good? In some cases, political reform. In some cases, technological advances. But you take the lessons learned from issues that were terrible and then suddenly were not so terrible, and smog is one and almost everywhere in the United States, you apply that to the present. Greenhouse gases fundamentally are an air pollution problem, and the previous two big air pollution problems, smog and acid rain, both were fixed faster and a lot more cheaply than anybody thought was possible, but with a combination in those cases of business models, regulatory reform, and technological advances. The same thing can happen with greenhouse gases. As soon as we get serious about them, and we haven't yet, really no nation on earth has gotten serious about greenhouse gases. Once we do, I think we're all but certain to have very rapid improvements.
How does optimism play into our enthusiasm for getting serious about greenhouse gases?
Well, see, I think optimism is the best argument for reform. If you're a pessimist, if you think the world really is going to hell, then we should build walls around the country. If you're an optimist, optimists believe that problems can be fixed. Optimists do not believe that everything is fine, far from it. An optimist should not be a Pollyanna smiling all the time. The difference is that optimists believe problems can be fixed. And if you believe that problems can be fixed and you look at climate change, it's a gigantic problem. There's a tiny chance that we'll be better off with climate change. It's far more likely that we'll be unhappy with the consequences. If you're an optimist, you think that reform will fix it. And so you don't sit around moaning. You roll your sleeves up and get to work.
Why are people living longer today?
Well, that is actually the increase in longevity is a big mystery in epidemiology. The fact of it is irrefutable. Since about the middle of the 19th century, newborns have been living about a, I'm trying to remember the exact number. It's 3 months longer for every 10 years. And the graph of this, I say in the book, looks like an escalator in a mall. Hmm. It's just going straight up at 45 degrees. It can, and it's true of almost every nation in the world, not just American lifespan, but global lifespans are rising pretty steadily and pretty smoothly. And the big mystery is that the rise doesn't accelerate a lot when there's a huge innovation like vaccines, and it doesn't decline a lot when there's a huge problem like the AIDS epidemic. Lifespans are just rising. And it's got to be some combination of better public sanitation, which is we all know take for granted but didn't exist until 100 years ago, better nutrition, a well-fed person is much more resistant to disease than a malnourished person is, better health care, better health technology, higher educations. If you try to take graphs, some people do this exercise where you take graphs of things that are changing and overlay them and try to see which one relates to another. The fact that two things happen at the same time doesn't always prove that one causes another, but it gives you some clue. The big thing that jumps out is that in the United States and Western Europe, longevity is rising in eerie sync with educational improvements. Education seems to, and it's not that knowing Dostoevsky causes you to live longer, but educated people, they're more likely to follow doctor's orders, they're more likely to follow nutrition guidelines, they're a lot less likely to smoke cigarettes. Education and longevity are linked in at least some way.
So UNESCO says the youth literacy rate has grown from 83% to 91% over the past couple of decades. That represents tens of millions more people entering the workforce with at least some education.
Oh, yeah. And you just think about global literacy. In the middle of the 19th century, 10% of the people in the world could read and write. Now it's almost 90%. And I don't know if we'll ever get to exactly 100%, but we're certainly on the way to almost everyone in the world being able to read and write. And the big shift there is education for girls. As recently as, I'm going to say a century ago, really half a century ago, a large cohort of the world's girls were not exposed to education in any meaningful way, certainly not book-based education, and now almost all of them are. It leads to higher education levels, higher literacy, and in the case of girls joining the educated segment of the world, it doubles the world's supply of ideas.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. First up, we have Jenny in Dallas. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Yes, I had a question.
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead.
You were talking about the misery index, and I was wondering if you've considered the intangible stresses that are so prevalent in modern society. I'm in my 50s, and I can say that I feel like the stress and the competition, whether it's getting into college, whether it's getting a job, just day-to-day life is so full of stress, and that can't really be measured. Do you think that has some effect on why people think things are worse than they are, even though the misery index itself is down?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, sure, Jenny. The misery index is a great objective barometer, but it doesn't tell us anything about our subjective selves, which you just mentioned. I think it's true that stress is worse than it used to be. And you don't have to take my word for it, because medical researchers who study cortisol, which is the mediating body substance for stress, find more of it in the bodies of people who are alive today than cortisol in the bodies of people who are alive a couple of generations ago. My wife and I have three kids. The youngest just graduated from college. And my experience of all three of those kids is that children today are under more stress than children were when I was young. So I think it's not just in your mind. The stress generated by society is rising. Certainly our culture is very superficial and very noisy and very stress-inducing. And social media, which is a phenomenon just of the last 10 years, I think that's fundamentally stress-inducing. Right now it's popular to be piling on Facebook. And you know what? I think we should pile on Facebook. I think Facebook and similar platforms are much strongly overstate negative news and social discord and give us the impression that everything's falling apart, regardless of whether that's true or not. So I think that feeling bad about the world causing stress, and stress is an actual medical condition, I think that's subjectively something that is in fact going on.
So you said a majority of people in the world, I think you said 70%, benefit from being able to participate in free and fair elections. Why do democracies tend to get richer than dictatorships?
Well, one of the chapters, and it's better than it looks, is titled "Why Don't the Dictators Win?" And everybody thought the dictators would win as recently as when Ronald Reagan was president and Jean Kirkpatrick was our ambassador to the United Nations. Kirkpatrick kept saying that it was completely pointless for us to expect democracy around the world, that the dictators would always win. So why don't the dictators win? I would like to believe that the main reason is that democracy is ethically superior to other forms of government, that human liberty, personal liberty, freedom of speech, private property, that these ideas make democracy better than other ways of organizing governments in ethical terms. And they do. But I think the main reasons are actually war and money. Democracies are much better at generating money than dictatorships are. And hands down success for democracies in terms of productive economies and generating hard currencies that people want. Democracies encourage and reward innovation. Dictatorships discourage innovation. So that makes democracies better at money. And if you wanted to pick the most important thing about the 20th century, you could have several basic nominees, but I would say that the most important thing about the 20th century is that every time democracy and dictatorship went to war, democracy won.
So most Americans feel like the economy is in a better place than it was a decade ago, but economic uncertainty is something that causes anybody to feel stressed when they're experiencing it. You say despite our anxiety, the economy does still function. It hasn't fallen apart, even in the mortgage meltdown of 2008.
Well, there have been all sorts of scares, and that was certainly one of them. It was a scary time. But in general, if you made a map or chart of the United States since its founding, each passing generation has lived better in the material terms than the generation that came before. We can't be sure, and we're living today better as a whole. I don't mean that there are rich people living better, but the middle class, the lower middle class, as a whole, Americans live the best today that they've ever lived. Now, obviously, there are horrible examples of people who have all kinds of financial trouble, but as a whole, we're living very well. Now, here's the thing. We can't be sure this will continue. I think we all as a society suffer from what I call collapse anxiety, the fear that right now there's plenty of food and goods in the stores. Right now unemployment is low. Things look pretty good. If you need a job, you can find one. Can we be sure this will continue? The answer is no, we can't. So I think this causes a constant form of low-level anxiety, even though I would put money on the idea that the economy won't collapse. I can't prove it, and neither can anybody else.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there some upside, Greg, to what we always hear about wage stagnation? What do we need to understand about that term?
Well, wages have not grown as much for the middle of the middle class in the last 20 years as they grew in the other parts of the post-war era. But wages are, of course, are the most important aspect of your family finances, but they don't define it. Buying power is what defines your family finances, and buying power isn't expressed by an equation. I'll give you kind of a conceptual equation. This isn't a math major equation. But you figure out your buying power by income minus taxes plus benefits divided by household size multiplied by rising or falling prices. And if you do that number, especially because of federal tax cuts, several of them in the last generation, but also rising federal benefits, lower consumer prices. Consumer prices have been consistently low for almost 25 years now, and slightly smaller household size, you get the average American's buying power going up about 3% per year, every year since World War II ended. And that rise varies very little, regardless of where economic growth is.
Why aren't we encouraged to high-five each other about that?
Oh, I think there's two things going on. One is just human nature is to feel sorry for ourselves. So even if your life is basically going well, there's always got to be a way that things could be better. So we tend to take whatever's going well for granted and feel bad about whatever could go better. But we also live in, I just mentioned taxes and benefits. We live in a world where government controls more and more of the GDP with each passing year. This is true in Western Europe as well, and the figures are somewhat similar. In the United States now, government at all levels controls about 30% of the GDP. 50 years ago, government at all levels controlled about 10% of the GDP. So the more government controls of the GDP, the more we think that, well, if I complain, government will give me more money. And a couple of generations ago, that wasn't the case.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Victoria calling from Houston. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, how are y'all?
Very well, thanks.
I just have a comment that I think the negativity or the pessimism that we as a society feel is enhanced by the 24-hour news cycle where people tune in more to bad news than good news. So they tend to play the bad news more, and that kind of feeds into this fear that, oh, yes, the world is bad. Look at all of this, and people tune out the good things.
What do you think, Greg?
Well, it's certainly true. You, all your listeners know the saying from the newspaper business, if it bleeds, it leads. And this is not new. The media has been emphasizing bad news for
forever.
Since forever, basically. And to a certain extent, it should. Now, suppose there were two televisions in your living room, and you turned on one, and there was a report of a building on fire close to your house, and you turned on the other, and they were broadcasting a Brookings Institution think tank report on improving infrastructure financing options. Which are the two stories you're going to watch? Bad news has a command on us that gradual improvement news does not. But now we get bad news from our phones and they follow us around. It used to be that if the newspaper came to your house and it had some bad news on the front page, you put the newspaper down on the kitchen table, you went to another room, the newspaper didn't get up and go with you. Your phone gets up and goes with you, and it has mainly bad news on it, and it follows you everywhere you go.
My guest is writer Greg Easterbrook. We're discussing his new book, It's Better Than It Looks, Reasons for Optimism in an Age of Fear. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We're at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Greg Easterbrook about his new book, It's Better Than It Looks, Reasons for Optimism in an Age of Fear. Join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You're a supporter, Greg, of the idea of a minimum basic income. How would that change life in a country like the U.S.?
Well, I think I spend the last couple of chapters of It's Better Than It Looks thinking about problems that appear impossible to us today, in the same way that you started with malnutrition at the top of the show. There was a point where malnutrition seemed like an impossible, unsolvable problem, and then it turned out that there were solutions. So the two main ones that I grapple with are climate change and financial inequality. Climate change, I think, is fundamentally an engineering challenge, and Americans are pretty damn good at engineering challenges. Financial inequality is different because it starts with education. We can't be sure where the global economy is going to go, but it seems like a pretty good bet that education will get more and more important. And what percentage of the American and European populations realistically can become college graduates? Could it be 40%? Could it even be 50%? Those are very ambitious goals. Let's say we achieve them. You still have half the American and European populations not being college graduates and not having a desirable place in an education-based economy. So what are you going to do about that? I think all roads lead to universal basic income. It's a concept that's going to need a lot of work. We need to get our financial house in order in many ways before we can even try it. Now, if you've seen the latest national debt projections, we need to get our financial house in order in any case. But I think that as time passes, and not 100 years from now, but only a generation or two from now, we will need to reorder society around some sort of premise that very highly educated people are super productive. They generate most of the wealth. Their wealth is taxed, it's distributed to everybody else. Not in communism. Communism's a total failure. But some kind of socialism-like / universal income will keep society from keep the glue of society together.
You also think maybe we could use public policy to encourage people to move from economically challenged areas to places where there are lots of jobs. What would happen to the cities people leave behind?
Well, the economist Tyler Cowen, who lives in the Washington, D.C. area, has written an entire book just about this, about how people should move more often. And while we think of America as a society of movers who pull up stakes and go wherever they please, in fact, in the last 50 years, Americans have moved less and less and less. And generally, when there's a boom somewhere, the way our economy is structured today, at least, it makes sense to move there. Right now, if you're living in the Ohio Valley, where unemployment is higher than the national norm, and you look at the figures for the Dakotas, where unemployment's about 1%, and jobs go begging, you know, you could just move to the Dakotas. Your ancestors did it, and it worked out pretty well for them. You could do it too.
All right, back to the phones. We have James calling us now from Houston. Hi, James.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm concerned about 20 years, 25 years from now, when automation, robotics, and all the fancy gadgets that will be taking the place of you know, skilled and professional workers. Any idea of what will be the percentage of unemployment, in, not alone here in the United States, but across the world? Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Sure, James. You know, just because the Luddites were wrong 200 years ago, I'm sure your listeners know who the Luddites were, doesn't mean that they will always be wrong. One thing that I grapple with, and it's better than it looks, is what if the Luddites ultimately turn out to be right? And automation does substantially reduce the number of jobs in society. It hasn't so far. If you looked at United States job numbers from a century ago, when 89% of Americans worked in agriculture, and you told, if you and I, Chris, were having this conversation 100 years ago, and you had said, I'm just looking at this study that projects that in the year 2018, only 2% of Americans will have jobs in agriculture because machines will be doing everything else, we would have said, oh my God, the world's going to end, but it didn't. We're all better off, including farmers. So when you look at these numbers in manufacturing, most of the job loss in manufacturing has not been caused by trade with China. It's been caused by factory automation, not robots with glowing eyes, but machines that do repetitive work. More of that stuff is coming. So we fear that it's going to result in no jobs at all for people that don't have college educations. I don't think that'll happen, but it's a valid fear. And of course, automation has not yet come for professionals. What if when you go to a lawyer, it's not a person, it's a small AI device that talks like Alexa does? So this could be a big factor in the near to midterm future. And that's one reason why I think, as I said earlier, that all roads lead to universal basic income.
Why did we decide that pessimism seems cooler or smarter than optimism?
Oh, one of the great things about my generation, I was born in 1953. One of the great things about my generation was the huge increase in the importance of going to college. Ideally, everybody would go to college, but everybody should at least have some exposure to college professors, to the college way of thinking. College has been really good for our country, and the successful nations in the world tend to have good colleges, and the failed nations of the world tend to not have good colleges. But what are you rewarded for in college. You're rewarded for sneering at all of the great thinkers of history. What are you taught? You're taught how to sneer at them. You're taught how to feel more important than them. You're taught how to find flaws in what all the artists and scientists and philosophers of history have proposed. And so we have this now. We have this very well-educated generation, and that's fabulous. But what are we really good at? We're really good at declaring that we're better than other people or better than other things or finding fault in other people's way of thinking. And now we apply that to society as a whole. Sorry, that's a long-winded way of answering that question.
That was a good answer. All right, let's go next to Ricardo in Fort Worth. Hi, Ricardo.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to go back to the point that was made, and I guess I just wanted to ask about it. The point about dictatorship versus democracy and the approach of Reagan in the world, and the question is that take an example of Chile in 1973, the forces of dictatorship that were completely backed by the U.S. that later was completely backed and financed by Reagan, those forces of dictatorship, they won out over forces of democracy. So I wanted to ask why the statement was made that the forces of democracy always win.
Well, when that point, Ricardo, was referring to war. When democracy and dictatorship have gone to war, democracies have always won. Now, does democracy always behave correctly? We all know the answer is that it doesn't. You don't. Vietnam, Chile, Iran, there's a lot of examples of the United States behaving in ways that nobody is proud of. And we're not unique in that regard. There are other great democracies in the world who have also behaved poorly, especially in colonial circumstances. But my point is that when push comes to shove and the two philosophies of government fight each other on the battlefield, democracy wins, and we hope that it always stays that way.
You say that nearly every important, just American reform of the past century today seems wise and cost-effective, right? Environmental conservation, labor laws, civil rights legislation, funding for scientific research. Why then are we so gun-shy about enacting further reforms now? Sometimes people treat reform efforts like they are deliberately trying to keep us back.
Well, and that point that all, as far as I can think of, basically all past reforms are viewed in retrospect as successful, and we're glad that we did them. A lot of those things that you just mentioned, Chris, environmental protection, civil rights, personal freedom, reduction of discrimination against women and gays. In every case, we look back at them and say, geez, why didn't we just do that sooner? And I think we're going to look back the same way in reforms against greenhouse gases and just say, why did we wait so long? Why didn't we just do that sooner? And we may eventually say that about economic reforms as well. But I think the reason that we don't hear so much about that right now, remember the most negative candidate in American history just won the presidency, is that we're living in an era where pessimism is respectable and optimism is not. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, trying to change that dynamic.
The book is called It's Better Than It Looks, Reasons for Optimism in an Age of Fear. My guest is writer Greg Easterbrook. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm curious, just your perspective on what you think the president's campaign strategy will be when he runs again. It's one thing to come in from the outside and say, everything's a mess and I alone can fix it. Do you think he will come across as quite optimistic when he runs again in 2020?
I wouldn't claim to be able to predict what Donald Trump is going to do in 2 years, because Donald Trump himself doesn't know what he's going to do tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. So there, I'm not sure. It is certainly true that in recent presidential election cycles, the party out of power has said, oh, it's terrible. Everything's so terrible. And I'm sure the Democrats, being the party out of power, will try that line in 2020. But to try to analyze Trump as if he were a wise political strategist, I don't think I'd go down that road.
I wonder the extent to which politics also shapes our feelings. If, you know, we're really partisan, really divided now, and if the people that we have jumped on the same team as are telling us things are terrible, we're inclined to assume they must be right.
Yes, I think it's naive to say, well, it's just recently that politics has become so partisan. American politics has always been partisan, except in time of war. People put partisanship aside. Otherwise, we've been pretty partisan. But I think there are a number of things going on in campaigning technology and culture that emphasize the negative over the positive, because the one thing that political groups can agree on is that they don't like other political groups. So who's ever at the top of the ticket is always trying to bring out the worst in the other parties. And since that way of speaking is protected by the First Amendment, I'm not sure short term, at least, what we do about it.
Do most people want to hear this stuff, Greg? Or when you talk about what's going right and what has succeeded, do you find people eager to poke holes in your optimism?
Well, I do. I do find this, Chris, that whenever I talk to audiences about this, suppose I give the numbers for rising longevity, and almost all disease rates are declining, and have some of them have declined pretty spectacularly. Somebody will always raise a hand and say, "How can you say that? I know someone who has cancer." And when I talk about how the economy is mainly better off, living standards are rising, buying power for every single person, but for almost all of us is up, somebody will always raise a hand and say, "How can you say that? I have a family member who's unemployed." I think we're used to thinking in terms of anecdotes. Anecdotes are powerful, and an individual story is always more interesting than the footnotes of a book. But the larger trends are what really matter. And the point that I endlessly make is that most things get better for most people in most categories. I certainly don't claim that everything's getting better for everybody. That's just not true. But in general, any person is better off being alive today than at any point in the past. And I think as a society, we have a lot of trouble addressing that really simple and I think close to unassailable thought.
So what's the value in acknowledging the improvements we've made?
If you do, then you're in favor of reform for the next phase of improvements. Like I said earlier, if you're a pessimist, if you think the world's going to hell, then why should you bother trying to reform anything? Just order champagne and while away the end of the world. But if you think that reforms of the past have worked and reforms of the present can work as well, then you want big reforms for climate change, inequality. You want living wages instead of the federal minimum wage. It's still very low in real dollar terms. You want those basic reforms because you think those reforms will work.
Are you a reformed worrier, or have you always seen the world this way?
I would say I've been studying this subject for about 25 years, and the more I learn, the more confident I am of nobody can be sure the future will be better. It would be crazy to say that you could be sure of that, but I think the odds are that the world will be better. I can tell you 25 years ago, I did a cover story for New Republic magazine, which 25 years ago was a highly credible and respected publication. That's changed since. But the title of the piece was America the Okay, this 25 years ago. And in it, I went through all these sociological indicators saying, hey, look at this. Things are getting better. Is this going to last? And it's 25 years later, and it's lasted.
The new book by journalist and author Greg Easterbrook is called It's Better Than It Looks, Reasons for Optimism in an Age of Fear. Greg, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink. Any app you use to find podcasts, you can also find and download the Think podcast, or you can get it at our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.